Bag huge savings on your painting projects at Menards. From your kitchen and bath to doors and trim, and even your ceilings, Dutch Boy has the perfect choice for your painting projects. Dutch Boy's DuraFighter is a tough paint and primer that provides great scrub resistance and durability. DuraFighter interior paint starts at $27.75 a gallon. Get an additional 15% savings on all Dutch Boy paints when you put it in the bag. See store for complete details.
Save big money at Menards.
We're starting things off with a word from our sponsor. Since 1998, DVD Netflix has delivered more than 5 billion DVD and Blu-ray rentals to movie lovers in every American zip code and to military bases around the world in their famous, iconic red envelopes. With an extensive library of titles from the early 1900s to today, and shows from such premium networks as HBO and Showtime, DVD Netflix is a must for physical media lovers. Featuring a variety of different plans starting at as little as $8.99 per month, it's a great way to experience DVDs and Blu-rays with special features and commentary tracks you won't find anywhere else. A member for over 20 years, so well before I ever began working with the service, as an official blogger on acting, or as a DVD, Netflix, Twitter film discussion host, I think it's a terrific way to keep our vintage video store memories alive and support the physical media that we love so much. So be sure to check out DVD Netflix for yourself at DVD.com. Now, on with the show.
Hey, this is Jen Johans at FilmIntuition.com and FilmIntuition on social media and Letterboxd. And this is Watch with Jen.
Today, I am so pleased to welcome Kristen Lopez back to the podcast. One of our very first guests, Kristen, who is currently the film editor of The Wrap and is also the creator of the classic film podcast Ticklish Business, has worked as an entertainment journalist for more than 15 years. And this year, she's published her very first book in conjunction with Turner Classic Movies, dedicated to literary adaptations, focused on 52 feature films and the works that inspired them. This cheerily written release entitled But Have You Read the Book is now available everywhere. And you should definitely check it out because it's a lot of fun. Kristen, thank you so much for being here. How are you doing? And how has this year been treating you so far?
I'm always happy to be back on the show. So thank you so much, first off. The year's been weird. If you had told me at the end of last year that I would be getting an entirely new job and that I would be doing all this to promote this book, I would not have believed you, which is shocking because I think I said that when they first asked me to like write a book. So it's been a lot in a very short amount of time.
Well, congratulations on the book. You said you were approached first. How did that happen?
Colleague at my former workplace who had written two books for TCM, and I assumed that, you know, TCM had massive requirements for whoever they used as an author. I mean, I assumed that you had to have written multiple books and, you know, that they were like the you know, high apotheosis of like you needed to prove that you could definitely do this. And my coworker said, you know, do you want to meet the person who runs the publishing team? And I was like, okay. And I did, the great John Malahai. He's fantastic. And we talked for, you know, about an hour about a lot of different things, none of which was this. And they eventually called me from TCM Publishing and they said, you know, we have some ideas for books that have already sold and we're looking for an author. And we noticed that you have a master's degree in English. So do you read a lot? Dude, that was hilarious twofold because yes, I do read a lot. And B, this was probably the only time anybody has referenced my master's degree at all since I obtained it. So it finally paid off. And I said, you know, yes. And they start talking about this idea about film adaptations. And as soon as they said that, I was already on board because I'm a person that is incredibly impatient. So, you know, as soon as like somebody I love gets cast in a movie, I go and I buy the book and I read it because I can't wait 2 years or a year, however long it takes for this movie to come out. I need to know what happens. I need to know what, how invested I need to be in this. Like, I like to spoil myself well ahead of time. So as soon as they said that, you know, I was on board. And so it was a perfect union of an idea that they had and a topic that I was already heavily into.
Yeah. And this all happened when you were the TV editor at IndieWire. And I was going to ask you, you know, how many years has this been in the works? And what was that like to have to juggle your day job with reading 52 books, plus all the other additional research materials I'm sure you picked up that are all over the bibliography?
It came about really quickly in, you know, end of 2020 into 2021. So I had already been, you know, working at IndieWire for a minute. And the pandemic had happened relatively quickly into the whole thing. And they had this idea. And I tell everybody, you know, that the only silver lining to a pandemic was that I had no social life. So it wasn't like I was going a lot of places. In 2021, things were kind of, we were learning how to mitigate and do yeah. things by that point. But it was still very, very minor. You know, and so I had kind of given myself a really strict schedule because from the time that we signed the contract and started, you know, I had about 8 months beginning to end, which is very, very short to read 52 books.
I was going to say, my goodness. Yeah.
Yeah. So I gave myself a really rigid schedule. I prioritized books that I had not read at all. You know, I had a list that was like books and movies I've never experienced, you know, books that I haven't read, but movies that I've seen, books that I've read and movies that I've seen, you know, so I kind of prioritized that. And made sure that I definitely focused on the stuff that I had never seen and never read. So every week I would start by watching the movie, and then I would cut the book up into sections and make sure that I read. And at the end of the week, I would write the chapter and then start it all over again on Sunday. And with my day job, you know, it was a lot of doing it in the morning or in the evening and on the weekends. And the last, like, week of writing, I've just holed up at the Hollywood Roosevelt Hotel in LA. I usually do like a Christmas treat to myself, and I hang out there, and I finished the book there kind of Jack Torrance style, just holed up. So it was a really, you know, perfect time to kind of get to be enmeshed in reading because I didn't have a lot going on. You know, so, and as far as the research process, you know, TCM had some requirements for things that they definitely wanted to include. Dune was their big film at the time. And so that was a requirement that they definitely wanted to include. And we both agreed that, you know, there needed to be diversity of eras, diversity of genres, diversity of authors, directors, make sure that you have people of color, women, you know, all these different elements. So, and it required me to not just have read the book and seen the movie, but, you know, trying to find something interesting to say in a chapter. You know, I would kind of do deep dives and like, what were the critics saying at the time? Mm-hmm. What's been written? So it was really great to kind of try to craft an arc for each book and movie, you know, something that was worth discussing about each of them.
Yeah, absolutely. I have not finished the book yet, but I've been
no judgment
all of what I have read so far. And it just, the amount of work, I mean, kudos to you. I can't even imagine. I wanted to know, you talked about all of this research and doing these back-to-back week in, week out, you're going to start noticing patterns of adaptations and the way things have changed over the years. So did you make any discoveries that kind of surprised you or, you know, stood out?
Yeah, I knew that each studio in the studio system had a person whose job was to read all of the popular books of the day and bring you know, write up about every book, about whether it was perceived as filmable. And what I noticed was how quickly in certain instances a movie could capitalize on the book's success. The studio system, you know, since movies were being made on a far smaller budget, a far smaller scale, in certain instances, you know, Gone with the Wind comes out and, you know, a couple years later you get the movie, you know. You could publish a book, you know, I think, what is it, To Kill a Mockingbird was written in like 61, movie comes out in 62, or I think the Harper movie might have been 1960. So you still have a very small truncated window because you could make a movie while a book was still popular. Nowadays, because you have a producer deciding what to make They got to get a director. They got to get the actors. They have to get special effects. You got to get the budget, script approval. It can take, you know, 5-10 years sometimes to adapt a popular book. So book isn't as popular by the time it gets to the screen. And I think the other thing I noticed, too, was just the fact that more people were reading during the studio system.
Yeah.
Because we didn't have TV. You didn't have social media. A book could really saturate the landscape in a really short amount of time. And somebody asked me recently, you know, what was the last time I thought that a book had that sort of cultural, like, saturation? And I think the last time I remember is, you know, the YA boom of the 2010s, you know, didn't have to read Harry Potter to know who Harry Potter was and Hogwarts. You didn't have to read The Hunger Games to know about what The Hunger Games were and who Katniss Everdeen is. You don't get that a lot, you know, at this point. Something like Gone with the Wind was a cultural juggernaut that influenced all of these other books and these imitators, and everybody knew Scarlett O'Hara. I don't necessarily think books transcend because there's so much content now, you know, and everything kind of gets lost in the void of stuff at this point.
Exactly. And so many things are turned into these prestige series. They're always 8 episodes long, like 8 is the magic number, or 10. And sometimes, you know, they don't need to be that long. But a lot of these books and these book clubs, I'm a member of Book of the Month. You know, there's Reese Witherspoon's book club, and Oprah had a book club. You know, a lot of these titles, especially women's titles, are kind of pushed into the streaming market or the television market instead of films nowadays. And so I thought this was a really interesting look back at, yes, we used to read and we used to value these properties and turn them into films, which is really interesting. And I think coming from your background where you worked in television, at least for your coverage, and then film, this would have been a perfect marriage with that master's degree of English. And I'm glad that paid off for sure. Yes, humanity.
My mother was very happy when it when somebody reiterated, she's like, see, you'll thank me. I knew you'd thank me later for telling you to just go right into it.
Oh, that's wonderful. And you recently had your book launch, and it was also at the festival. It's been at the Academy Museum, I think I heard. And so the book is kind of taking off all in the same month. How were all of these events and the festival, and what was all that like?
Very weird. Very, very weird. You know, up until recently, I go to events with an eye towards, like, this. I just don't want to get COVID. Like, that's my thing nowadays. I'm like, you know, and to be at the festival and have people, you know, kind of put a book in front of me and expect me to sign it, or, you know, ask to, like, take my picture, you know, it's very weird, especially, you know, somebody that writes about, you know, celebrity and film and television, to be on the other side of it is very bizarre. You know, I always tell people, like, I don't think I'm cool enough for that to be the case. But it was great. You know, I definitely have plans next year. I've not so subtly told TCM, like, next year I'm around to do more. You know, if you want to let me, like, introduce something, I have a list of ideas prepped from the book. So fingers crossed that it's not just a one and done thing.
Yes, I was going to ask you about that because I can't remember if it was online or in another interview where you were kind of teasing maybe the second book. Oh, I think in your intro to this book, you were saying, you know, I couldn't do all the films, and so maybe book two. So would you want to explore this topic, or do you have other topics kind of percolating?
I mean, I have a lot of other ideas, you know, because I talk a lot. I mean, I contain multitudes, you know, I'm fascinated by so many different things that there's a couple of different things in the works that are way too early to talk about, you know. But far as, like, a sequel, everybody asks me, like, oh, what would you include in a sequel? And I think just in the last, like, 6 months, I mean, there's plenty to include. I mean, this weekend alone, we have Are You There, God? It's Me, Margaret, which is a seminal book. That took, you know, decades to get to the screen. So I definitely every time that there's an adaptation, like, I keep it in the back of my mind, like, that would be a great idea for book two. You know, I tell people now that I've written it, you know, and I they tell you not to read the reviews, which I don't, but I do look kind of like vaguely, like I'll scroll through comments and, you know, a couple people have said like, there's not enough opinion. Like, I don't know whether she likes the movie or the book better, which is intentional.
Completely.
I didn't
objective.
Want people to not read the book. The title is called, But Have You Read the Book? So I very deliberately did not pick books that I don't like, which I could have, because there are some movies that I think are better than the book. But I didn't pick those. And I also didn't, you know, want to include too much of my own, you know, opinion, just in case, you know, somebody might be turned off from wanting to read it. But, you know, I told my book publisher people, I'm like, you know, well, if this is a, you know, success and we do a second one, I don't know, I might get a little, you know, I might get a little more opinionated, or I might just pick like utterly random movies and adaptations that nobody cares about but me, just so that like
they're back in
little taste of my thought process.
That's a really good idea. I was going to ask you, what are some of your favorite adaptations of all time?
Oh my gosh, I mean, Wuthering Heights is up there. It's the book that made me love books. The original, yeah. Okay. Yeah, it's the book that made me love books, and the 1930s version. It's not the book, but it's a beautiful, beautiful movie, and it's so fantastic that it's just, it's perfect. I didn't put one of the things I lovingly got told when I sent them my short list was I had too many crime dramas and mystery books in the list. They're like, you can't do Dennis Lane's entire filmography. but I really wish that I could have included, you know, I love Mystic River.
Goodness, one of the masterpieces. Yes,
one of the best. And Clint Eastwood makes really deliberate choices in the book or in the film, some that I agree with, some that I don't. But
the
I think
Kevin Bacon
good...
character. Yes.
Yes, the Kevin
so
Bacon
much
character.
Stronger.
You know, the fact that I think that he tries to kind of sympathize and downplay Sean Penn's like villainy. Like the book version of Sean Penn's character is far more like just cold towards the end in the book. Gone Baby Gone is another one too that I almost wanted to include. The book is fantastic. It's so good. Yes. The ending though is completely different. Mm-hmm. It's a bit more like, if you've seen the movie ends on a bit of an ambiguous, like, did he make the right decision note? The film pretty much says like, in some instances it's good. Like, you know, mm-hmm. like we should have just done the way things were. And then the other one that I always throw out, the movie did not do well. The book is not necessarily considered a classic, but I love Don Winslow's Savages that they adapted in 2012.
Oh, yes. Blake Lively.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's such an intense, just really fun read. It's very quick. It's written in poetry style, so it's very short, you know, mm-hmm. very brisk writing. It's so dark, and it's got a lot of like subtle humor. It's great. The movie is about 90% there. I tell people, if they want to see a really great adaptation, you turn it off at the first ending. Do not watch the second ending, which was studio mandated. And it's not. I've been fortunate to kind of lovingly rib Don Winslow and been like, why did you had that happy ending? He's like, that was not me, that was Oliver Stone.
Yeah.
And I'm like, wow. But those are some of my favorites, you know, that are just really, I think, great examples of like how you can translate very different genres.
Yeah, no, and I love that you chose those, because I think the obvious choices people would have immediately gone for are like The Godfather and Jaws and those kind of films, and they're seminal classics. So I do love that you chose some surprises there. I think Mystic River was an incident where I finished the book. It was like, I was very excited to see the film, and I was reading it, and I always would go to the movies on Halloween. And so it was like Halloween, and I finished it kind of in the theater. I was there too early. And so I watched and read it like way too close together. I still love the movie, of course, but part of me was just aching for the Kevin Bacon character from the book to be translated on the screen. But I mean, what a brilliant adaptation. I also really enjoyed it. Is different than the book, of course, all the pretty horses. And I loved your section on No Country for Old Men. So you could do a whole Cormac McCarthy thing. I mean, Blood Meridian, they always say that we're going to be making it, but allegedly they're going to make it again. So That would be exciting too. You could get back in your mystery thriller roots there.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, Cormac McCarthy is one of those, like, you have to pick really specific choices because I think they've only adapted two so far. The No Country and The Road, which The Road is also very, like, dark and cynical. You know, and No Country is a really great example of how an adaptation can be almost literal. Because the novel is about, you know, 90% verbatim what is in the film, but the tone is different. You know, McCarthy's tone is far more nihilist and political and angry. And, you know, some of you can read that coin toss scene in the book, and it's hard to read it without thinking of the version that is in the film and getting those moments of levity. But the way McCarthy is presenting it is far more dour and far scary. Yeah. So it's a great example of how a director and a screenwriter can take that text and actually lift it and do nothing different with the dialogue, but create all of these different things that change the tone and the intent compared to what you're reading.
Yes, and what an actor can bring to a certain line read, like Inherent Vice is another option, because that is so much the novel. Exactly. Yeah. So when I was bringing you on, I said we should probably talk about a couple adaptations, and you mentioned not really choosing books that you disliked, but I mean, To Have and Have Not is not one of Hemingway's best. I mean, we say that lovingly, it's Hemingway's brilliant writer. But talk to me about this adaptation and your thoughts.
Yeah, so To Have and Have Not was the last book that I had to read. It was literally the last one. And I started to read it, and I got about 10 pages in, and I was like, oh no, this is unrepentantly racist.
Oh yeah,
I'm talking like racial slurs are just being thrown all over the place. And I texted my editor, and I was like, I don't know if I feel comfortable endorsing this book as like one anybody should read. And he was like, well, you know, you could always pick a different Hemingway. You know, you could do like For Whom the Bell Tolls or Farewell to Arms or, you know, and I was
Sun
like,
Sun Also Rises. Yeah.
Sun Also Rises. I was like, can we do like Old Man in the Sea? Cause that was short.
Oh, he's yes.
Like, no, it's a novella. It doesn't count.
Okay.
And at that point I'm like, it's the last one. I've already watched the movie. I feel like I've come too far. So I just decided it's the one time that I was like, you know what? Let's make the arc about how everyone knew it's a terrible book. You know, Howard Hawks knew it was awful. He got drunk with Ernest Hemingway one day and said that he could make a great adaptation out of one of Hemingway's worst books. And Hemingway said, sure.
On their fishing trip. Like, that was day one. Like, I can do this. Yeah.
Yeah. And what ended up happening is Hawks and Hemingway ended up having a falling out, never spoke to each other again, because Hawks pitched it to so many different studios who would kind of look at it and try to develop it and then say, eh, no, we're not interested. He made more money off of pitching the book than Hemingway got selling him the rights to it, which really irked Hemingway.
Yeah, I read they didn't speak for 3 months because Hawks like got 10 times more money. And, you know, and it's one of the only times I think I read, or maybe the only time, that we had two Nobel winners of literature working on it, not at the same time or in the same room. God, that would have been cool, or be a fly on that wall. We had Hemingway and then also Faulkner, who was the one that ended up adapting it. But also, I mean, it's a lot of Hawks. It's also a lot of Hawks's wife, from what I understand.
It's very much a Casablanca ripoff.
It is.
You know, which was intentional. You know, the studio was like, you know, we want to do something that's a follow-up to Casablanca. They changed it to like French Martinique is where it takes place. And what's funny is I saw Rio Bravo this at the TCM Film Festival, and I'd never seen it before. And I started watching it, and I was like, this is just To Have and Have Not, only with in the West, you know, because especially the dynamic between Angie Dickinson and John Wayne in that movie. There's even a moment where they have a kissing scene and she responds very similarly to Lauren Bacall's response in To Have and Have Not, but it's better when you help line, which I was just like, Fox is just retreading his own stuff at this point.
He did that all the time. It's so funny, isn't it? Because like even in Only Angels Have Wings, like mm-hmm. Dean Arthur says, yeah. you know, I'm hard to get. All I have to do is ask. And then yeah. a few years later, Lauren Bacall says the same thing. And yeah, I mean, that's one thing I love about Hawks. He like straight up remade Rio Bravo as El Dorado, too. I mean, it's the same yeah. thing.
And, exactly. Yeah. You gotta love a director that is totally okay resting on their laurels.
Yeah.
But I think what I mean, to Have and Have Not is fun. You know, again, it's a Casablanca ripoff more, I think, than a Hemingway adaptation. For me, the best version of the book is The Breaking Point, which they did in 1950. John Garfield is fantastic, and I'm not saying that because I love him so much.
I know.
But I
everybody
think
does.
everybody should. Yes. But I think that it's also a nice, sly little like FU to Hemingway, that movie, because the main character in that movie, next to John Garfield, is Juano Hernandez,
yeah.
who plays Garfield's right-hand man. And when his character, it's not a spoiler, the movie is old, you should have seen it already. But when yeah. the character dies, very abruptly, very rudely, you're like yep. traumatized. And the ending especially is not about Garfield, it's about his character. Mm-hmm. And so I'd like to think that that's their sly little like, your book is ridiculously racist, so we're going to kind of retcon it and make it less racist by making the main character a man of color.
Yeah. No, and as far as, you know, this was the first movie with Bogie and Bacall. She was 19,
yeah.
fell in love with, you know, Bogart. He was married and 45 years old at the time, and everyone knows the story. But, you know, they made four films together.
Yeah.
What is your favorite of the Bogie Bacalls?
I like the other adaptation of theirs, The Big Sleep.
Yes.
I think that movie is fantastic. Martha Vickers is so fantastic in that. Allegedly, she was too good. And Lauren Bacall had her part reduced. What I think is funny, though, is that it's based on a Raymond Chandler novel of the yeah. same name, which they had to already kind of heavily change. It involves like pornography and a lot of illicit sex. But there was a point where famously in the movie, they had to figure out who murdered one of the characters. And they went to Chandler.
Yeah.
And Chandler's like, hell if I know, you know,
I
wrote the thing, which I think is funny. You know, a lot of authors tried their hand at screenwriting, you know, Fitzgerald mm-hmm. very famously, Dashiell Hammett, I think, made it through like one Thin Man and, yep. You know, couldn't hack it and couldn't write another Thin Man after that. You know, most people assume the series is a series of books. It's not, it's one book.
No.
And he never touched the characters again. But I think that it's interesting to look at the success stories in that regard. I mean, the most successful, I think, screenwriter/authors, you know, work with strong directors, you know, Mario Puzo working with Coppola on The Godfather,
yeah.
Nick Pelagi working with Scorsese on Goodfellas, you know, because you have a person that knows the filmic intent versus the person that knows the text. Sometimes
yep.
if you're too close to a text, you know, you can't figure out what works on the page versus what works on a screen.
Yeah, exactly. Or Jay Cox, who was a Time critic, you know, working with Scorsese on the adaptation of Age of Innocence, which is in my head because we're recording this on Michelle Pfeiffer and Daniel Day-Lewis's birthday. Yes, exactly. And next film that I suggested we discuss is a masterpiece, I think. I mean, everyone says it's synonymous with Gregory Peck and it's, you know, Harper Lee's beloved novel. So let's talk about To Kill a Mockingbird.
Yeah. Mockingbird, it came out relatively quickly after
yeah.
the book was published. And what I was surprised by, I haven't read To Kill a Mockingbird since middle school, you know,
okay.
high school. I had not revisited it, and I'd seen the movie, you know, and I remember really appreciating the movie, but to watch the movie and reread the book so close together, I realized how much of Harper Lee's text really is kind of a slice of life type of story.
Mm-hmm.
It tells a lot of different things in Scout's life. Hortonfoot knew that he had to condense that and tell one story, so the Tom Robinson trial becomes
the central
thing. But to read the book, you know, Harper Lee based a lot of Atticus Finch on her own father,
yeah.
A lot of the Robinson trial on various, you know, Black men that had been accused.
Mm-hmm.
But what I was struck by is how she writes about what we now commonly know as white privilege. You know, there's
yes.
scene There's a scene in the book where Calpurnia, who is a far bigger presence in the book than she does in the film.
So much more complex. She has a family, everything. Yeah.
She does. And I was really surprised by that because the film is so often considered this landmark for racism and looking at racial injustice. And yet the character that actually is a Black woman is so marginalized within the film. But in the book, she takes Scout and Jem to church. Yes. And there's a sequence where Jem starts to get nervous about the group of predominantly Black people converging on her and Jem. And, you know, you read that today and you're like, she's exhibiting white privilege and racial bias. And we's talking about this in 1960. You know, the character, you know, Jem is, or Scout is learning about racism. And is also not immune from that, you know, whereas the film kind of presents her as this innocent babe in the woods who has not been molded yet to experience racism. You know, I think that that famous scene of her talking to Atticus and asking him about the N-word, you know, to read it in the book with all that has happened, you're like, you question it more. You question her motivations and you question, you know, how much of what she is experiencing is now, you know, a lot of the racial bias that we're seeing. So it's really, really fascinating. And there's also a heavy emphasis on women in Scout's life. You know, so much of the book is about Scout realizing her place in society.
Everything.
Yeah. You get Calpurnia, you get Miss Maudie Atkins, who's kind of the female foil to Atticus Finch.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of different things that, you know, were really surprising that I hadn't realized the book just kind of threw, or the film just kind of threw out. So not that I want a mini series where we see all this, you know, but I know that when Go Set a Watchman came out, which was based on Harper Lee's like unpublished early ideas for Mockingbird, you know, talked about Atticus Finch maybe being a racist. I was like, if you read the book though, that what To Kill a Mockingbird ended up being, you know, Scout is not a, you know, racist in the common definition of how we would define that, but she still exhibits a lot of racist ideology in some instances, which I think the book treats honestly and openly. So it was great to get to reread
it.
So I was really happy that I got to reread and notice, like, oh, the movie has its own agenda, you know. It's, and I think that that's a common thing for 60s cinema in America at the time, you know. I love Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, but it's, you know, it's very much for the fence-sitters.
Yes.
It's very much for people that were already kind of like, I support this already and just needed a push. And I think that for as fantastic as To Kill a Mockingbird is, the film, it kind of plays, it's preaching to a choir that already believes in what it's saying. Whereas I think the book is more open to being like, if
let's
you think that this
it.
Is,
yes.
Yeah, let's discuss it. If you, how, what, if you're thinking that Scout is this way, why is that? You know, what does that say about you, the reader? Which is fascinating.
Yeah, and there's so much to that because the young boy in the book is based on her best friend, Truman Capote. His aunt has a little bit of a bigger role in the book as well. So there's a lot there. And when you said you're not asking for a miniseries, no, we don't want to give Hollywood ideas. But you can see somebody like a Todd Haynes who tackled Mildred Pierce very lovingly and, you know, to show the different shades that weren't in the classic movie in that miniseries. Somebody like that, you know, we could maybe trust, you know, or like a Small Axe situation where we have all sides and it's very interesting and we get to see all and explore all of these characters and facets would be interesting. But I think it's really good to read that book and compare it. And I think that makes it much more powerful. I know I was reading, actually, Roger Ebert was calling out the movie at the time as being like a white savior film. And, you know, where are the Black people? This is the South. And so there were some critics pushing back on that. Pauline Kael, famously. Of course, Pauline Kael likes to push back on everything. Yes. Anything, she's going to push back on it. And you talked about Horton Foote. And I think I really loved his adaptation of Mice and Men that he did for director and star Gary Sinise, because he kind of made the female character in that one, the Steinbeck, much more like we can understand her a little more. She isn't just a temptress or something. And so I appreciated that. So I think Horton Foote being a playwright, definitely could figure out what to pare down, but also respect the source material. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. And then another one of my, actually, I think it is my favorite book of all time, is The Great Gatsby. And so I was going to ask you, how did you choose? Was it because you were looking for more modern adaptations to go with this one versus the, you know, god-awful version in the 70s with Redford and Mia Farrow? Or how did you select it?
Yeah, so I had originally sent them a short list that stopped at Jurassic Park. And they said, Kristen, adaptations didn't stop in 95 just because TCM is classic, like you need to include contemporary stuff. So I was like, fine. And I was definitely looking back at like great examples of, you know, great American literature, like what haven't I talked about. And I think that the Robert Redford version is not nearly as well remembered as the Baz Luhrmann one, just because of time and excess and all that. I have as much of an antipathy towards the Redford one as most people do. I think it's a very dry version of the book.
Yeah, it's very stale.
It's very stale, but I think Redford's doing a lot of the heavy lifting.
Yes. Farrow was kind of miscast. Yeah.
Well, I think most of the Daisy Buchanans are fairly miscast. I have not seen the Alan Ladd version that I think is from the 40s, which is very rarely screened. So I put the Luhrmann on there because I know that a lot of people tend to have opinions about that one. I personally think that much like the 70s version, I have issues with the casting. Yeah. You know, I think that Tobey Maguire is very, very, he's much like Sam Waterston. You know, Nick Carraway is not supposed to be a very colorful character. He is the guy from which we see everything. I think that Luhrmann's excess ends up obscuring a lot of what makes the book memorable, even though I love the soundtrack. There's a couple moments that I thought were just a little veering on racism in the film.
A little bit.
You know, I think he just smothers it with so much Luhrmann cheese that it ends up obscuring.
Exoticism. And, yeah.
Exactly. But I mean, to the point, I think what makes it fascinating is that Gatsby always seems to be a character that Hollywood understands implicitly who you cast. You pick the biggest, grandest example of a movie star. Yes. And in the 1970s, you couldn't have found a better example of a golden boy than Robert Redford.
Yep.
In 2013, it was still Leonardo DiCaprio, who in many ways is very Gatsby-like. Like, we don't know anything about what he does in his free time that is not invented by him. Like, he controls the narrative, much like Jay Gatsby himself does. So there's a really, really cool, like, art imitating life, imitating art type of thing to his casting. And I think the movie definitely tries to do what Greta Gerwig does better, which is like, if you've seen the Luhrmann version of Gatsby, it ends with Nick drying out in a sanitarium in the film, which is not in the book. And he's
It's very Moulin Rouge.
He's telling this story and, you know, is writing this diary and it's called The Great Gatsby. I think like at one point he crosses out, like he adds great in there. And it doesn't work. Like Nick Carraway is not nearly as dynamic of a character to conceive of writing all this out, and it makes you question like how much of this is true. I don't think Nick Carraway as a character is that inventive. Gerwig does that whole concept of like, let's look at the creation of this text far better with Little Women, which would come out, you know, a couple years later, which also ends with the main character Joe March crafting this story called Little Women. But I think in that case, it works better because she's, I think, using that more to critique the legacy that is Little Women and how much of this is like representing this model of femininity that we no longer need. Luhrmann, I think, just uses it more as like a cool way to end the story that again is like Moulin Rouge.
A little bit. Yeah, I am not the greatest fan of Luhrmann. I appreciate what he does. I think, you know, Moulin Rouge is my favorite one. But for Lerman, I think the guy has trouble with beginnings too. That's like his big Achilles heel, is how do we get into the story? And sometimes it's so excessive and so much that we lose the emotional connection. I think overall it is a strong adaptation. I'm somebody who loves the book so much. I used to read it like all the time. So, you know, I'm going to be a little bit harder on it. But I think by the time I saw it in 2013, I hadn't read it in a little bit. So I was probably a little bit of a better audience for it. When you talk about Nick Carraway, did you ever see the cable movie version of this with Paul Rudd in Carraway's role?
No, I actually like that concept.
Yeah, he was really good. Mira Sorvino as Daisy Buchanan.
Well, that's weird.
And yeah, I don't know if that one was like the best cast. I think it's on YouTube, but I thought Paul Rudd, as far as all the Nick Carraways go, like you can see Rudd. That yeah. I remember. That's the thing I remember about that TV movie, and thinking, boy, that was a good choice. And so I think, you know, something like that. I also thought, as much as I love Joel Edgerton and other films, I thought he was kind of, it didn't really work. We needed an even greater contrast, I think, between him and the Jay Gatsby character. I'm glad you brought up the Gerwig Little Women adaptation. I'm someone who a bit older than Kristen. So I think my, you know, I remember going to the theater and reading the book, kind of like your stories of doing that ahead of time too. I am someone who loves the Gillian Armstrong version.
That one's mine. Yeah. Okay. That's the one I grew up with. Yeah.
Yes. But I did really appreciate the changes that Gerwig made, and the way it looks like, you know, Joseph Singer Sargent painting at times. And yeah, so that was a really good adaptation the last few years. What have been some of your favorite recent adaptations besides the Gerwig?
Oh gosh. I was telling people about some of the things that, you know, we could include in a volume two, and, you know, what are some good recent adaptations? I think Are You There, God? It's Me, Margaret is definitely a great adaptation of that book. That probably couldn't have been done even, you know, a decade ago, you know, in terms of just like being open and frank about like all of the topics that that book is open to. I love the Agatha Christie, Kenneth Branagh adaptation of Death on the Nile, which exactly. Not a popular choice. I think that I remember going to see that movie and being like, you know, I remember being very meh on Murder on the Orient Express and just being like, that's fine. And the minute that that movie starts by giving us backstory on Poirot's mustache, and then segues.
I loved the backstory, didn't you?
Yeah. I was like, why do we need backstory on how he got his mustache? Didn't ask for it. And then it segues into this like hot, horny, sweaty, like dance sequence. Yeah. There's Gal Gadot like trying to seduce Armie Hammer on a Sphinx. It is just the weirdest like attempt at being sexy. And I was like, I didn't ask for this version of Agatha Christie, but I am ridiculously fascinated and interested in it. I think it's just, and now he's doing like complete 360 with the next one, Haunting in Venice, which is looking like some sort of like dark chamber ghost story. I love that Branagh's keeping me on my toes. You know, another adaptation I really liked was Bullet Train. I'm biased because I love me some ATJ. To read the book is, you know, it's very, very Japanese. It's very slow, very contemplative. Uh-huh. You know, spends a lot of time looking at like character motivation and superstition and all of that, which the movie just decides like we're living up to the title. It's just a big dumb action movie, but it does have a really like inventive running through line in the book that is not in the film regarding how everybody dies that I still think is very funny. So those are some of the more recent ones where I'm like, these are worth discussing in some way.
They're doing it right. Yeah. And as far as some of your favorite books that have not been adapted yet that you think would be excellent films, do you have like a little wish list?
Oh gosh. I mean, I definitely, you know, to go back to Dennis Lehane, I keep saying, you know, Gone Baby Gone adapted the Kenzie Gennaro series, series of books. Mm-hmm. But I think, and as much as Gone Baby Gone is like a nice way in, the best book is actually book two in that series. Gone Baby Gone is book three, but it's called Darkness Take My Hand. And it is just bleak as hell. It's got like an intense finale that I can just see in my head as being very cinematic. Like, you need like almost like a Scorsese, you know, or some type of character that can, or, you know, like a, I don't want Nick Pizzolatto to deal with it, but like somebody like him without all the baggage, you know, to handle it. I'm kind of shocked. I know Apple was talking about developing a series based on the characters, and that didn't happen. So I would love somebody to just adapt that one, just that one book. A lot of Matt Ruff's books, I think, are really good. He was the person that had wrote the book that became Lovecraft Country. And he has a lot of really bizarre books that have fantastic plots. I have no idea how they would be adapted. He has one book called Set This House in Order. It's about a guy with multiple personalities. And before you say it sounds like Split Note is way better than Split.
Okay, good.
But it's a very interesting like look at identity and family and personality that's really good. He also did another one about characters living in like a Sims-like AV world. That is also very great. And they're really good stories that like have a gimmick to them. So I think those would be fantastic, like if somebody has some money and wants to find a way to adapt those. They're definitely fantastic stories first, and also have really interesting ways into the narrative.
That sounds great. Well, Kristen, I want to thank you so much for doing this. I really appreciated talking to you. And yeah, this was a real treat. And congratulations again on the book. I'm so proud. And I was so excited to hear that it was coming out and then to finally get it in my hands. So I want to thank you.
Anytime. I know we've been talking about doing this for a while, so anytime you think that I am cool enough to have on, I don't always take it lightly.
Thank you. I also want to thank everyone for listening, especially my patrons who support the show and help fund my research, equipment, film rentals, RSS fees, and more for as little as $1 per month at the Film Intuition Patreon, which is the home base for the show. Other ways you can support the podcast are by sharing, reviewing, and subscribing to Watch with Jen wherever you get your podcasts, and also checking out the cool merch store hosted and created by our talented logo designer, Kate Gabrielle. You can find the merchandise store, including shirts, tote bags, stickers, and more by visiting filmintuition.com and clicking on the shop link. The show's theme music is Solo Acoustic Guitar by Jason Shaw and is available in the free music archive. You can also reach me or interact with Watch with Jen anytime on Twitter, either at Film Intuition or our Watch with Jen account as well. Well, until next time, please take care and happy movie watching.
This is Jen Johans at filmintuition.com and Film Intuition on social media and Letterboxd. And this is Watch with Jen.